Not until mid-August did Lewis receive Dearborn's letter of rebuke, dated July 2nd. Nor until then did Dearborn receive Lewis's report of July 1st, which was then passed on to Jefferson at Monticello, since Dearborn was in Maine. The maddening slowness of the mails made a difficult situation worse. On August 20th, Lewis replied to Dearborn. He got immediately to the point. "I shall in future be as cautious with respect to my requisitions on the regular troops as you can possibly wish me." Of course, there was an immediate but. "When you take into view, sir, my great distance from the seat of the general government, surrounded as I am with numerous faithless and savage nations, it is obvious that many cases will arise which require my acting before it is possible I can consult." That got him into a convoluted sentence of explanation. "I have ever thought it better not to act at all than to act erroneously, and I shall certainly not lay myself liable hereafter to the censure of the executive under this head, though I shall ever feel a pleasure in exercising to the best of my judgment and abilities such discretionary powers as they may think proper to confide to me." He went on at great length to defend what he had done. After nearly 1,000 words on the subject, he concluded, "This has been an extremely perplexing, toilsome, and disagreeable business to me throughout, and I must candidly confess that it is not rendered less so at this moment in reflection than it was in practice from the seeming disapprobation which you appear to have to the measures pursued." Jefferson, meanwhile, replied on August 21st to Lewis's July 1st report to Dearborn. Although he had privately expressed fear that Lewis had been too prompt in committing us with the Osages, he told Lewis only that he regretted that it has been necessary to come to open rupture with the Osages, but being so, I approve of the course you have pursued in permitting the other nations to take their own satisfaction for the wrongs they complain of. Indeed, the commander-in-chief was willing to go further and supply the guns and ammunition the Indians attacking the Osages would need, a strange action for a man who wanted peace among all the inhabitants of Louisiana. But Jefferson did not approve at all of sending the Boylven expedition to snatch the accused murderers from the Sauks and the Foxes, and hoped that nothing had happened yet. If Boylven had brought in some accused Indians, Jefferson told Lewis to give time, for indulgence on both sides is just and necessary in such cases. Like every 19th-century president, Jefferson could not set and hold to a consistent Indian policy. This reflected the pressures he was under. On the one side, there were questions of morality and law and order, and certainly the white frontiersmen committed many an outrage on the Indians before crying for help when retribution came. On the other side, the Indians could not be controlled with good intentions, and American citizens had to be protected. Jefferson hoped it could be done without bloodshed, but controlled they must be. Jefferson told Lewis, "Commerce is the great engine by which we are to coerce them, and not war." The operative verb in the sentence was coerce. Thus, in the Boylven matter, Jefferson approved of Lewis's requisition for arms and militia expenses, but in passing this along to Dearborn, he expressed the hope that Lewis would be able to settle with the Sauks and the Foxes without war, to which he seems too much committed. From the territorial governor's point of view, that was a lovely sentiment, but too mushy for practical affairs. As Lewis had put it in his report to Dearborn, "I sincerely hope that the general government in their philanthropic feelings towards the Indians will not lose sight of the safety of our defenseless and extended frontiers." 3 days later, Jefferson again wrote Lewis. He had just heard of Lewis's statement in early July that 3 Iowas were to be hanged for murder. He hoped it would not be done, "as we know we cannot punish any murder which shall be committed by us on them, even if the murderer can be taken. Our juries have never yet convicted the murderer of an Indian." If a hanging was necessary, he instructed Lewis to limit it to 1 man, the most guilty and worst character, because only 1 white man had been killed. Lewis kept the Indians in jail, from which they escaped in the summer of 1809. Jefferson next turned to a much more important matter, one on which Lewis had been inexcusably lax, as far as Jefferson knew. "I am uneasy," the president wrote, "hearing nothing from you about the Mandan chief, nor the measures for restoring him to his country." Once more, Jefferson authorized in advance any measures Lewis might consider necessary, saying that the return of Big White is an object which presses on our justice and our honor. And farther than that, I suppose a severe punishment of the Ricaras indispensable, taking for it our own time and convenience. The president signed off, "I repeat my salutations of affection and respect." Lewis spent much of his time on the routine business of government. His duties put him in contact with men who had been or would be famous, most notably Daniel Boone and Moses Austin. He appointed Boone Justice of the District of Femme Osage. He had various dealings with Austin, who held lands west of St. Louis that were rich in lead. Austin expressed his confidence in Lewis, but warned him that the bickering parties in the territory would attempt to drive a wedge between the governor and Secretary Bates. Austin later commented that a breach between the two has already taken place, and Governor Lewis has expressed his dissatisfaction of the secretary's conduct. Indeed, Lewis had dismissed a number of office holders, some of them Burrites who had been appointed by Wilkinson, others friends of Bates. In the process, he made enemies. The governor created what amounted to an Indian territory, access to which by whites would be controlled by him. His purpose was to prevent claim jumpers and squatters from taking up lands. There was much grumbling about this. When he issued orders suspending all trading with the Great Osages, he made more enemies. When Clark established Fort Osage on the river by that name, he negotiated a treaty establishing a boundary line. When the Great Osages learned that the treaty forbade them to cross to the east of the line, they complained that they had never understood the treaty, and anyway, only the Little Osages had agreed to it. Lewis then commissioned Pierre Chouteau to go to Fort Osage and negotiate a new treaty. Lewis's instructions to Chouteau were solidly in the tradition of treaty making with the Indians. A line should be drawn that assures to them for their exclusive use the lands west of the boundary line. That was a backward way of saying the Osages would be selling the land east of the line. Any Osages who refuse to make their mark on the treaty can have no future hopes, for it is our unalterable determination that if they are to be considered our friends and allies, they must sign that instrument and conform to its stipulations. Those who obeyed would have trade goods aplenty, plus a blacksmith shop and the horsepower mill Clark had brought to St. Louis. Those who resisted would be cut off completely from all trade goods. The Osages did as they were told, adopting the treaty on November 10, 1808. It was ratified by the U.S. Senate, unanimously, on April 28, 1810. The governor enacted a law to permit villages to incorporate as towns, and laid out a road from St. Louis to St. Genevieve, Cape Girardeau, and New Madrid. He oversaw the construction of a shot tower and arranged for the exploration of nearby saltpeter caves. Lewis's relations with Clark were excellent, as always. He borrowed money from Clark regularly. On one occasion, he recorded in his account book, "Borrowed of General Clark this sum, $1, at a card party in my room." On another occasion, he borrowed $6, which he then loaned to his brother, Reuben. On October 7th, it was $50 for an unstated purpose. On October 28th, Clark loaned him $49.50 for 2 barrels of whiskey. In August, when one of Clark's slaves ran away, Lewis gave York $4 for his expenses as he searched for the man. That indicates a high level of trust in York, but nevertheless, Clark was upset with York. York was demanding his freedom as his reward for his services on the expedition. His wife belonged to someone else and lived in Louisville, Kentucky. When Clark refused to free him, York asked to be allowed to go to Louisville. Clark agreed to send him there, but only for a visit. In a November 9, 1808 letter to his brother Jonathan, Clark explained that he would send York and permit him to stay a few weeks with his wife. He wishes to stay there altogether and hire himself. A fairly common practice, York was proposing to hire himself out and send the money his labor earned to Clark, which I have refused. He prefers being sold to returning here, but he is serviceable to me at this place, and I am determined not to sell him to gratify him, and have directed him to return to this place this fall. If any attempt is made by York to run off or refuse to perform his duty as a slave, I wish him sent to New Orleans and sold, or hired out to some severe master until he thinks better of such conduct. I do not wish him to know my determination if he conducts himself well." York continued to argue that he should be set free. Clark lamented to his brother, "I did wish to do well by him, York, but as he has got such a notion about freedom and his eminence services on the expedition, that I do not expect he will be of much service to me again." Clark fretted over the situation. He discussed it with Lewis. In a late 1808 letter to his brother, Clark wrote, "I do not care for York's being in this country. I have got a little displeased with him and intended to have punished him, but Governor Lewis has insisted on my only hiring him out in Kentucky, which perhaps will be best." Clark hoped that York would learn a lesson from a severe master and thus give over that wife of his to return to St. Louis. York was not the only slave causing Clark problems. He wrote Jonathan that he was often much vexed and perplexed with my few Negroes, so much so that he had been forced to chastise them and was considering selling all but four, not only to relieve the frustration of dealing with them, but to obtain badly needed money. Still, he was troubled by his temptation to sell his slaves. "I wish I was near enough to counsel with you a little on this subject. Will you write a few lines about this inclination of mine to turn Negroes into goods and cash?" In May 1809, York returned to St. Louis. "York brought my horse," Clark wrote. "He is here, but of very little service to me, insolent and sulky. I gave him a severe trouncing the other day, and he has much mended." No commentary is necessary. Much of the evil of slavery is encapsulated in this little story, not least Jefferson's realism about the effect of slavery on the morals and manners of the slaveholder. York had helped pole Clark's keelboat, paddled his canoe, hunted for his meat, made his fire, had shown he was prepared to sacrifice his life to save Clark's, crossed the continent and returned with his childhood companion, only to be beaten because he was insolent and sulky, and denied not only his freedom, but his wife, and, we may suppose, children. That Lewis's attitude was somewhat softer is obvious, but it is highly unlikely that he ever told Clark to grant York his freedom. Lewis could no more escape the lord and master attitude toward black slaves than Clark could, or come to that, than Jefferson could. Jefferson also sold slaves and separated families. No wonder Jefferson could write, "I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just." In the late fall of 1808, war with Great Britain appeared imminent. To prepare for it, President Jefferson asked the nation to raise 100,000 men. Louisiana's quota was a mere 377. Lewis used the pages of the Missouri Gazette to appeal to the patriotism of the young men of his country, mainly relying on the Anglophobia of the French and American inhabitants to get a response. He urged the young men to join in defending our liberties and our country from the unhallowed grasp of the modern barbarians of Europe, who, insatiate with the horrid butcheries of the Eastern world, are now bending their course towards our peaceful and happy shore. With them, power begets right, and justice is laughed to scorn. They are destitute of magnanimity and virtue. Lewis asked that volunteers sign up for 12-month service and thus prove themselves worthy of their fathers of 76, whose bequests, purchased with their blood, are those rights we now enjoy and so justly prize. Let us then defend and preserve them, regardless of what it may cost, that they may pass unimpaired to the generation who are to succeed us. The response, sad to relate, hardly matched Lewis's eloquence. Only a few dozen Americans, and no Frenchmen, rallied to the call to arms. Still, Lewis's first 9 months in St. Louis had been busy and relatively successful. He had avoided, although only barely, an Indian war. He had established some law and order on the frontier. He was putting his own men into office. He was building roads and making other improvements. The St. Louis, Missouri River Fur Company was a going concern. But there was much he had not done, most especially on the two matters that most concerned Jefferson. Big White was still in town. And there the journals sat. Lewis apparently never even opened them. Chapter 36. St. Louis. January to August, 1809. Great joy in camp. Julia Clark has had a baby. William Clark names him Meriwether Lewis Clark. Clark gives a set of Shakespeare to the teenage mother. Great excitement in St. Louis. The St. Louis, Missouri River Fur Company is preparing to ascend the river. There are job opportunities for voyagers, for men willing to join the militia, for Indians looking for employment and a chance to get some revenge on the Arikaras and Sioux. For Lewis, there is much planning and packing to supervise. It is reminiscent of the winter of 1803-4, when the city had been all hustle and bustle helping Lewis and Clark get ready for their expedition. Especially for Lewis, who was almost as busy as in 1804. The terms of the contract he signed with the Missouri River Fur Company and the orders he gave the commander, Pierre Chouteau, show how active and productive he was in the winter and spring of 1809, how much he drew on what he had learned about going up the Missouri, how much attention he paid to detail, how imaginative he was, how much thought he put into the task, and how ruthless he could be. But there was a dark side to his life. It is barely hinted at in the available contemporary documents, but something was bothering him. His drinking, apparently, was heavy. He was taking medicine regularly, medicine laced with opium or morphine. His account book contains many references to those medicines, which he indicated he took to deal with malaria attacks. He swallowed a pill containing a gram of opium every night at bedtime to ward off such attacks, and three a night when suffering a fever. If they do not operate, he took two more in the morning. He said repeatedly he needed to go back east, wanted to go back east, intended to go back east, that he would be off in a few days, but he didn't go. He was borrowing small sums regularly from the Chouteaus, and on May 17th borrowed $20 from Bates. He did not state the reason for the loans. It is possible that they were for drinking money. His finances were in a sorry state, as shown by a November 9th entry in his account book. Borrowed of General Clark this sum, $49, to pay Dr. Farrow for his attendance on my servant Pernia, an account which I consider exorbitant, but which my situation in life compels me to pay. In the orders he gave the expedition carrying Big White about how to handle the Arikaras, he was bloodthirsty to a shocking degree and displayed an alarming lack of common sense. Meanwhile, Secretary Bates had a public scene with Governor Lewis, and the two top officials in Louisiana broke off relations. Lewis's behavior had become erratic. On February 24th, Lewis signed the contract with the St. Louis, Missouri River Fur Company in his capacity as governor of the territory of Louisiana on behalf of the United States of America. The terms were explicit. The company promised to raise 125 militiamen, of whom at least 40 shall be Americans and expert riflemen, for the purpose of returning Big White and his party to the Mandan Nation. The company was required to provide the militia with good and suitable firearms, of which 50 at least shall be rifles, the numbers and quality to be approved by Lewis. All other expenses, provisions, utensils, boats, Indian presents, and so on, would be borne by the partners. Governor Lewis would sign drafts for the supplies as an advance to be deducted from the final payment. The company pledged to deliver Big White and party safely, to defend them from all warlike attacks at the risk of their lives. When the job was done, the United States would pay the company $7,000. Pierre Chouteau of the company would command the expedition until it reached the Mandans and returned Big White. At that point, the military functions would end and command would go over to another partner, Manuel Lisa, who would push off with the company's men for the Yellowstone and beyond in a commercial operation. It would have a monopoly. Lewis pledged to issue no license to any trader for any part of the Missouri higher than the mouth of the Platte River. The company shall, without any pretense of delay whatsoever, embark, start, and proceed on before the 10th day of May next, under the penalty for default in the amount of $3,000. The United States would advance the company up to $3,500 after the expedition was fully formed and equipped. Should Lewis be absent from St. Louis, he authorized General Clark to act in his place. Both sides were delighted with the contract. For Lewis and for the partners, it made perfect sense to combine the military expedition with a commercial venture. After all, the Army had tried in 1807 with Ensign Pryor and been turned back, with a loss of 3 lives, George Shannon's leg, and 7 others wounded. The Army could not possibly detach a force of 125 men to do the job. As for the partners, they could not expect to get a trading group past the Arikaras without military escort. Frontier Army officers and officials of the government regularly engaged in private ventures on the frontier. And obviously, it was as much in the government's interest as it was in the company's that the Missouri be opened to American fur traders. Nevertheless, the contract opened Lewis to severe criticism. He had engaged the services of a private company, paying it with government funds. Any profits made from the commercial venture would be shared by his friend William Clark and Lewis's brother Reuben, and apparently Lewis himself. But on the early 19th century frontier, these were fairly commonplace arrangements. In fact, Dearborn had set a precedent when he authorized Clark to give an exclusive trading license to private traders willing to accompany the prior expedition. Lewis had an explicit authorization for such expenditures from Jefferson, but in a month Jefferson would be leaving office, and the new president, James Madison, and his Secretary of War, William Eustis, were set on saving money, not taking on new obligations.